do.
I guess I can do it.
And all the words you want.
Do we have to repeat it? Having been advised that the blood has returned to the transcriptionist's hands, we will proceed, if we can find Dr. Marino now.
I think Dr. Gerhardt's cloning him right now.
Cloning him, okay.
Cloning is called.
Oh, jeez. Do you want to say
probably
that?
Probably 10,000 sperm for it. They never asked for questions.
That's funny, Jeff. He's at the University of Virginia, right? Dr. Marino, we were almost going to conduct a lottery for your slot, so...
Can I bid?
You're still there.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to talk to you this evening. I'm going to be quite aware that, you know, even legislators have personal lives, so I'm going to try to be very concise, and I will mainly confine myself to describing the subcommittee, the committee of the National Academies, which I served as co-chair, some of its conclusions that are relevant to your discussion. The Committee on Guidelines for Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research, the pre-publication version of our report, which I believe you have, concluded its work with a public announcement on April 26th of this year. I was co-chair along with Richard Hines, who is a distinguished cancer geneticist at MIT. The report was co-sponsored by the National Academies and the Institute of Medicine. I'm sure you all know that the academies are not government agencies. They are chartered by the federal government. The reports have no legal standing, as critics of our own report have pointed out to us. They only have intellectual suasion. This project, although about 90% of the budget of the National Academies collectively comes from work that is requested by Congress or the executive branch, this particular project was supported by two foundations and some internal National Academies funds. You may recall that in 2002 the Academies recommended that both adult and human embryonic stem cell research go forward in other reports. These were the members of the committee. This was not exclusively a science committee by any means, nor, in fact, are all the physicians working scientists. Several of them are clinical ethicists. There's an anthropologist, a law professor, two law professors, in fact. So this was not dominated or intended to be dominated by scientists. The academies don't pick up a project unless there's either a mandate from Congress or the executive branch, or there's perceived to be a very important public need expressed through the scientific communities. In this case, because human embryonic stem cell research is underway and it appears to be moving ahead with both federal and non-federal funding, that is to say state initiatives and private efforts that you're aware of, this was felt to be something that the scientific community really needed to take on. Currently, although it's often said that there's no regulation of human ESR research, in fact, there are various regulations that apply at various levels of the work, including the fact that the FDA has stated its jurisdiction over this work because there's more than minimal manipulation, quote unquote, of the cells involved. Nonetheless, there is no system of oversight for this research, which concerned the academies and the scientists who urged that they create this project that we did. And there is obviously great uncertainty in the scientific community about the appropriate procedures, as well as in the general public, for doing this research. So the task that we were given was to develop guidelines to encourage responsible practices in this area, including the use and derivation of new stem cell lines derived from surplus blastocysts from IVF clinics, from blastocysts produced with donated gametes, and from blastocysts produced using nuclear transfer. And we were told that our guidelines should take ethical and legal concerns into account, and as well as taking recognition of the basic science and health science policy issues related to this work. These were the issues that we considered. You can see them before you. I won't read all the titles to you. And these were the chapters of the report, which actually has just been published and is available for a modest fee from the National Academies Press. Not so modest, in fact. That's how they make their money, by selling the few reports that actually sell. And I think this one will. So addressing the question of reproductive uses of nuclear transfer, that is an area that we were not asked to consider. We simply cited in our report the conclusion that had already been reached by the National Academies that human reproductive cloning should not now be practiced. It is dangerous and likely to fail. And this continues to be the view of the National Academies, that human reproductive cloning, somatic cell nuclear transfer, and scientific parlance should not take place. This is what the guidelines cover. The guidelines cover blastocysts from these two sources, and they cover somatic cell nuclear transfer, the transfer of somatic cell nuclei into eggs. We note that, in fact, many of the guidelines address issues that are common to other areas of research as well. For example, human adult stem cell research and research that uses fetal stem cells or embryonic germ cells derived from fetal tissue. So our hope is actually that these guidelines help in these other areas as well. Our guidelines recommend that donations of blastocysts, oocytes, sperm, and somatic cells should only proceed under certain circumstances, that they should always be reviewed by an institutional review board, not now required, by the way, that they should be governed by the informed consent of all donors. It's not clear, for example, that the 22 lines that are qualified for federal funding have been accompanied by the informed consent of all the donors. So we actually draw a higher bar than is currently required in this respect as well. We required in our guidelines that the decision to donate blastocysts, oocytes, or sperm be separated from any reimbursement either to the donor or to the in vitro fertilization clinic that is providing the material. So we ban any purchase or sale of this material. And we require, and we talk at length about, the need for donor privacy and how this can be obtained. We're very concerned about the fact that there really is no oversight at this time. So we encourage both local oversight and a national oversight. The local oversight is in the form of what we came to call embryonic stem cell research oversight committees that should be established by or be available to any research institution that is doing this work, and it should have the appropriate expertise. We hesitated, and you can imagine that our science colleagues were not happy with the idea of yet another committee at the university, another bureaucratic hurdle to get over to do their work. But when we literally put all of the different kinds of committees at a research center that would have to be involved with this process on a blackboard, and I think we stopped counting at half a dozen. Biosafety committees, the IRB, the radiation committees, the animal care committee, probably the university's conflict of interest committee, and so on and so forth. And we said, you know, there's just no way out of this. There needs to be an entity that can coordinate all this. We also encouraged I suppose you would say, society at large, somebody somewhere, to create a national panel in the absence of federal oversight, again, to assess the adequacy of our guidelines, to revisit them as public attitudes and as the science progresses, as new issues come up. And we had several criteria that we offered for this panel. These are the functions of the proposed escrow committees. And you'll see that they're pretty much the kinds of functions that you would expect from this oversight system, from any oversight system. And in particular, we distinguished between several different kinds of research with regard to the role of the escrow. So for example, in A, there is research that's permissible after notification of this escrow committee and the completion of all other reviews, animal care, biosafety, whatever they happen to be, that research would be permissible really only with the escrow committee being aware that it's being done. So in vitro research, for example, which doesn't involve putting any cells into living things, but is being done in the laboratory in a dish, that generally is something that the escrow committee should know about, which, by the way, currently would not be the case. There's no mechanism for universities or research centers necessarily to know anything about who's doing what in their labs with stem cells. The second category of research would be research that's permissible only after additional review and approval by the escrow committee. And so the three kinds of research that fell in this category for us would be all derivations of new human embryonic stem cell lines from donated blastocysts, from IVF clinic oocytes, or from nuclear transfer. All research involving the introduction of human embryonic stem cells into non-human animals at any stage of embryonic, fetal, or postnatal development, and this gets us into the chimera issue, which I'll come back to, which somewhat to our surprise after the release of our report was the item that most captured the public imagination. And finally, all research in which identifiable information about donors is readily ascertainable or could become known by the investigator. And the reason for this is we're worried about privacy and confidentiality, and when identifiable information about the donor linked to it, they become a human subject, and that becomes much more complex, and we wanted to make sure that the escrow committees took a good look at that. Research that should not be permitted this time, in other words, even with escrow oversight, would not be permitted, in our view, would be research involving any in vitro culturing of human embryos beyond 14 days. Some of you are probably familiar with the fact that this 14-day barrier is well established in international research circles, in fact, for the last 20-plus years, although, in fact, it doesn't really apply to human ESL research. As you know, this is derived from six-day-old embryos, normally 5 or 6 day-old embryos. Also not permitted, research in which human embryonic stem cells are introduced into non-human primate blastocysts or in which any embryonic stem cells are introduced into human blastocysts. Again, this goes to the chimera issue. There are some worries that most people I talk to, many think are science fiction, but nonetheless concerns that if you could somehow grow a mouse brain with all human neural cells that you might have a talking mouse. Quite apart from whether this is a realistic possibility or not,
I think we have one. His name is Mickey.
Yeah. There's a patent issue about that with Disney, though, and I'm going to talk
to...
I'm going to talk to a learned attorney about that later.
Thank you very much. We are paying attention. I mean, that's...
Yeah. As a philosopher giving a lecture in the evening, that's very reassuring to know that. So there are clearly powerful issues that are raised by the questions of chimeras, particularly when the brain is involved. And we can talk, if we have time, about whether chimeric organisms are of less concern when other organs are involved. But these, and the scientists can tell you, these so-called chimeras, we already have lots of them in laboratories, and they're basically all it means is they're mixtures of cells from different sources. People who have immune systems from their siblings, for example, are, by some definitions, chimeras.
Dr. Barrios,
yes.
What, in light of what both witnesses said before, that the implantation can take place either at 7 or 10 or whatever days, 14 days is clearly after implantation. So what is the reason why 14 days is picked as opposed to 17 or 13,
right?
Or, you know, what's the essential difference?
As the research, good question. As the research goes forward, it's likely that there will be more embryos being used in research in laboratories. And we wanted to make it clear that as the American scientific community, the 14-day period is sacrosanct, that you can't go past that period to do any embryo research. This is a standard that's been well established abroad, particularly in the UK, which is the first place that established the 14-day standard. And the reason for that is that it's roughly around 14 days that the so-called primitive streak appears in the embryo. It begins to have a top and a bottom and so forth, and that's the beginning of the nerve of the central nervous
system. You mean
the
spinal cord?
Yeah, the beginning of the central nervous system. This is about as far as my embryology goes, by the way.
Okay.
And we can talk more about the complicated policy issue, the question of how you reach a moral conclusion using biological information, but this is a case in which this has been done around the world. Chimera is generally discouraged, except in lower animals, and in no animal, even in lower animals in which chimeras have been created, should they be allowed to breed, there is some chance that you'll change species lines if you start to do that. As I mentioned earlier, one of the concerns that critics of the report have is that, well, we really can't legalize these things. When this is a matter of the scientific community getting together and agreeing they're going to do this, how do we know they'll comply? In my experience, scientists like two things. They like to be funded, and they like to publish. So if we can get the funders and the journal editors to agree that these are the rules, and that scientists have to ensure compliance with these rules when they apply for funding or when they publish their papers, that will be a measure of success with respect to ensuring compliance. A brief list of some of the individuals and organizations that have endorsed the guidelines. One of the big concerns is, how do we know the scientific community is serious about this and really can discipline itself? As a non-scientist, I'm quite familiar with the tendency that some other of my non-science friends have to think that scientists want to go in there and have fun in the laboratory and do whatever they want. They want to press on and be a footnote to history and get famous. How do we know that they're really going to discipline themselves? I think that the scientific community can discipline itself, and I think there's evidence from this list, which is only a partial list, that is exactly what's going on in light of our recommendations. Just a couple of sort of recent news items. The California Institute for Regenerative Medicine has adopted the guidelines as interim policy. Other states are talking about adopting the guidelines as policy. And I just noticed, I threw this in a few days ago, India, of all places, has referenced the guidelines as one source of guidance in developing their policy. I believe the same thing is happening in other places as well. To conclude, I haven't talked like a philosopher. I've sounded like a regulator, and perhaps we'll have more time for the metaphysics in the next few minutes, but I do want to associate myself with Senator Frist's comment the other day. I think that if we're talking about the philosophical issues involved, we're talking about, of course, the question of potentiality, of at what point is the human embryo, does it have the same moral status as a human person? And as you know, there are great disagreements about this question. I only want to assert what I think is true, that it is not self-evident It is not self-evident that the human person is present in the embryo or that the human embryo has the same moral status as a human person in later development. If it were self-evident that that were true, we wouldn't be having these arguments. And I think reasonable people, people of faith, people of various traditions can disagree about this question. The great Abrahamic religions disagree about this question. Islam, Judaism, and many Protestant denominations do not view the human embryo as the equivalent moral status to a human person. There's a second principle that I want to just cite to you at the risk of sounding like I'm having flashback of by the philosophy seminars I used to teach 20 years ago to adults at night. And of course they were on the edge of their seats when I was giving these lectures, but the other final observation I want to make is this. There's another moral principle at stake here. In all the Abrahamic traditions, there is a commitment that it says that every member of the faith is supposed to improve the world. In Judaism, we call it tikkun olam, to heal the world. And I view science as a moral enterprise. It is clearly a profession. There are legal implications. There's big money involved. At bottom, what we're talking about is improving the human condition. And so the hard part for people like you who are policymakers, and it's easy for me to spout off, the hard part for people like you is how to integrate these principles and these considerations into sound public policy. Thank you.
I just would comment that, you know, this is Virginia, and we're the state that the Supreme Court sustained the decision Buck versus Bell in application of eugenic policies. We have a special obligation to be exquisitely sensitive in what we're doing here.
Yes, sir. And in fact, I'm happy to say that my good friend and colleague Paul Lombardo in the Center for Biomedical Ethics is responsible for many of the apologies and much of the realization of that history. I would also say that we have to be very careful in drawing historic analogies. And so I absolutely recognize the special responsibility of Virginia, and it's also very important to be thoughtful about what lessons we take away from those episodes.
Let me ask a question. Do you think we bestow dignity or do we recognize dignity?
I think that the problem is not bestowal or recognition so much, sir, I think, as what we mean by dignity. It turns out to be very hard to know exactly what people mean when they use that expression.
I think you used the term, though.
I didn't.
Worth, moral worth. I'm sorry.
Moral worth, moral status.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go back then. Do we bestow moral worth or do we recognize moral worth?
I think you're probably not going to be surprised to hear me say it's a combination. I think that there are certain markers that we use that are present in the world, certain facts, and that we as societies and religious traditions also merge those facts with values. And I'm afraid that there's no hard and fast rule for the way that this happens. But there are some limit conditions. And worrying about the exploitation of innocent human persons and their destruction is a limit condition. The difficulty, again, is how we decide at what point in biological development we have an individual that has that status.
Let me tell you where I'm deriving this, and I don't want to monopolize this, and anybody else jump in. At the end of the book of The Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis, or actually in the beginning of it, talks about an English lesson. And the discussion goes, do I have sublime feelings about a waterfall, or is the waterfall sublime?
Yes.
So either value is there, and I recognize it, or I get to impute it. If I get to impute it, I can do a lot of things. If I don't, then I've got to be very sensitive that I've got the right filters on, that I'm looking at this as it should be looked at, or as it is in itself.
And my response to Lewis would be that that's what the logicians call a false dilemma, that the matter is more complex, and that there's a very complicated interaction between the way we come upon our experience and the way that we understand it and value it.
Well, I think we have a real dilemma. That's why we're having this committee here to try to figure this out. Does anybody else have any questions? And Dr. Moreno?
Hi.
Yes.
If I recall correctly, when Dr. Gerhardt spoke, he said that he regretted the scientific community's use of the phrase therapeutic cloning. And people have started talking about nucleus transfer. I noticed on some of your first slides, Dr. Moreno, you talked about donated blastocysts instead of embryos, and I just wondered if that was an intentional change in the semantics.
Well, the reality is that people tend to use the word embryo to refer to a number of states in the development of this entity. And when we could in the guidelines, we wanted to be specific and talk about blood. When we were talking about a certain developmental stage, we wanted to talk about blasts, use that particular word. When we were not talking about a particular stage, but a period, a longer period, we would use the word embryo. So I wasn't trying to, I'm not trying to hide behind the language or change the language, which we were trying to be specific about what stage of development we were talking about.
And so would research be done on blastocysts or on embryos?
Well, the research that we're talking about with respect to the deriving human ES cells would be done on what the scientists would prefer to call blastocyst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been a continuing debate about this also, whether about whether human cloning should rather be called, as I've been calling it and others have been calling it, nuclear transfer. The reason the allegation is that scientists don't like to talk about human cloning because of the bad vibes, the political problems that it creates for them, and that they're trying to hide behind. But the fact is that from a science point of view, and I'm not a scientist again, what they've taught me is that somatic cell nuclear transfer is the descriptor. And in fact, of course, the term cloning, as Drs. Friedman and Gerhardt can tell you better than me, is not a descriptive term, not a useful term at all in this context. The any of you had wine for dinner last night? The grapes that went into your wine were cloned. So the problem is to try to use the language that is the most precise.
Senator Powell.
You've worked so hard on these recommendations. I'm sure you've thought through the best ways that various policymakers can use them. Do you have suggestions to us as how the Commonwealth of Virginia might implement them?
Well, you're getting above my pay grade, Senator.
I'm above mine, too.
At $17.6 a year, it's easy to get above our pay grade, so...
As my former, one of my old professors say, for my sins, I worked on this thing for a year and over a year, and you know, of course, would be wonderful from my point of view if the state in which I work and where my university is so prominent, if that work could go toward developing policy for the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I. Obviously, it would be very satisfying. So I would say, take it, run with it, apply it.
I guess what I'm asking is the next step. What's the best ways to apply it? Would you suggest?
Oh gosh, is your question a technical question of I'm not somebody who drafts legislation, so I'm not sure what the best way would be.
For example, Mr. Chairman, but, if I might, so, would you suggest we put these in legislation? Would you suggest we require them of our publicly funded colleges and universities? I mean, how do you view
I think that all work in the Commonwealth of Virginia that involves the derivation of human ES cells should be required to follow these guidelines. Now, having said that, the reality is that the conditions will change, new problems will come up, there has to be some opportunity for revision. It may be that the subcommittee that you all enjoy serving on so much should function as the entity that's called back every 2 or 3 years periodically to revisit the guidelines, making more work for all of you.
Let me... A further question?
No, just a comment. We would, of course, follow your lead because you'll be back every 2 years.
Well, no. We may not, but he will be. Let me ask a question if nobody else has the question. Since you're an ethicist, a moralist philosopher, how do you derive a standard for risk? In other words, Dr. Gerhardt says he doesn't want to take these derivative lines and put them in people yet because the risk is too high, the risk of whatever it is, and Dr. Friedman says whether it's 1 in 4 or 1 in 100 or whatever. And also, in other words, how do you establish a standard for, I guess you super-ovulate women to get the embryos? I mean, I don't know medically if there's a risk from that or not, but in other words, where do you, what standard do you put out there to apply for, yes, you should do this therapy, or no, you should not, or you should not donate these ova for...
Dr. Frieden wants to answer that. So with respect specifically to the role of the egg donor, we took some hits, I suppose, in the science world because we said that, in the in vitro fertilization world in particular, we said that there should be no payment, that we do not want to turn women from donors into vendors. And that's partly because there is a, some would say 8%, some say 5%, some say less risk of hyperstimulation syndrome, which could in some instances end up women in the hospital. So that's an issue about the safety of donors and, you know, living organ donors, an area that I'm interested in. There are also risks about living organ donation as well. So that's, we thought that to keep this as clear and clean as possible and to eliminate conflicts of interest that could interfere with reasonable risk assessment, there shouldn't be payment.
How do you avoid?
You cannot.
Did you finish it?
The direct answer to your question, sir, is you cannot avoid the risks. And I my ears pricked a little while ago when people were talking about the downstream risks to the health of people who got cells someday. And the fact that, as was pointed out, you can't know. Well, you can't know about the downstream risks of any drug that's approved by the FDA. The FDA does not do 20, 30-year longitudinal studies of a drug before it licenses it. So this is not a new problem. This is and this is why many people say we need to have a much better post-marketing system to pick up these adverse events than we have now. I think we should. It'll cost money. And it needs to be applied to this area as well as to more traditional pharmaceuticals.
Turning back to the experience of Virginia, which was set with a eugenics background, when you do the screening for donors, I mean, I've looked at some of these lists. You don't necessarily want blonde, blue-eyed Nordics, but boy, you ask a lot of questions. How is this not getting us into a eugenics mindset where, you know what, we don't want people with club feet. And we don't want these other kind of people. We only want a certain type. I mean, how do you avoid the eugenics conundrum or whatever it is?
It seems to me, first of all, there's quite a difference between state-sponsored eugenics, which is the Buck v. Bell problem, and what I like to call consumer eugenics. And here we get into a fascinating problem of human enhancement. So the fact is that I can send my daughter for tennis lessons and math tutoring, and somebody else in Virginia can't. Is that substantially different from deciding whether I want to choose which embryo is implanted in my wife and I in her uterus?
You're not altering who your daughter is. You're perfecting a talent that she has. You're not saying, I'm going to graft onto her a talent that she would never have had she not had this gene therapy.
That's not at all clear. First of all, I'm not persuaded that if I had had math tutoring when I needed it, I would have gone to medical school the way my father wanted me to instead of gotten a PhD in philosophy because I was a better writer than mathematician. So I'm not persuaded, nor am I persuaded that changing genes, as we well know and the scientists can tell you, there's not a one-to-one correspondence between genetic endowment and a certain expressed characteristic. So I'm afraid it's squishier than drawing a line between one kind of enhancement and another.
Right.
Also, of course, in this country, as you well know, we do believe in reproductive freedom.
We're here to ask questions that have ethical implications.
Yes.
And you're the first of the ethicists that's appearing, and we're going to have one more, possibly two more, that are going to ask this, and we're going to ask hopefully the same questions or that we're going there. But we have a...
Can I say one last thing about this?
Yes.
I do think, sir, perhaps you and I won't live to see it, that we do face the prospect of significant differences in the offspring of people who can access genetic technologies and these other technologies, and we as a society may have to face the inequalities of opportunity that are created by those interventions. So I'm not waving that aside. I think that is going to be a problem probably for people who come after us.
Question.
I just want to make a clarification. Having worked a lot with donor situations, both sperm banks and donor banks, most people, when they choose traits, that match the partner that is having the donation on their behalf. So if it's a sperm donor, they usually match towards the husband's characteristics. If it's an egg donor, they match towards the wife's characteristics. And there's enough diversity that there isn't any one particular type that's always selected.
There are these exceptions of people who, as the delegate said, are looking for a 6-foot blonde who's with 1,500 SATs. I had a student who was a candidate for one of those, as a matter of fact.
You bring up an interesting question point, and that's a few years ago there was a website called Ron's Angels talking about models and donating eggs from models. And I was just totally surprised at the number of people that thought cosmetic surgery was inheritable.
The Soviets thought so too.
Does anybody have any other questions of Dr. Moreno? If not, we thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Father Ted, would you please, if you need the...